morning. This is Tuesday, August 28th, 2012, City Council work session. Present today is City Manager Matthew Brower, Councilman Jay Musley, Councilman John McLeod, Councilman Daniel Owen, and myself, Councilwoman Susie Heimbachel. Councilwoman Rich and Mayor Gwynn are not present today. The first topic this morning is a presentation on the redistricting, and I'll turn that over to Mr. Brower.
Thank you, Council President. If your permission, we're actually going to take him in reverse order and begin with the Sunshine Law update.
Okay.
The City Attorney, Pat Gilligan's got another obligation at the top of the hour, and so I've asked that he go ahead and go first. After we address C, we'll go ahead and circle back up to items A and B, which is the presentation concerning redistricting, as well as, of course, the wayfinding.
Okay.
And so if there's no questions or issues with that, I'll turn the time over to City Attorney Pat Gilligan.
Thank you.
I've done this seminar about 10 times, and every time I've started it with a story that Ty's that are shaking his head, no, because he's heard the story 10 times. It takes about 10 minutes to tell, so I don't have I'll have to regale you with it another day. It's my favorite story of all time. But you don't have time for that day. I've handed out to you what we hand out to when I do the seminar, the full seminar. Some of you may have attended it. I think, Jay, you may have. All the boards, members, we do it every 2 years, I think. The clerk's office schedules it because we get new board members. And so we do it then. So I've handed that out. And I'm not going to do anything on ethics, sunshine law, or public records, but it's in there just so you have it. It's a handy dandy guide, and we're going to talk about quasi judicial hearings, just quasi judicial hearings, and take your questions on that because I have a limited amount of time. But I will reiterate what I think I've told each one of you privately. I haven't had a council member of mine ever been accused of a public record, sunshine law, or ethics violation. So, and I want to continue with that perfect record. So, because it doesn't look good if it happens. So, so my only thing is, when in doubt, just call me, and we'll talk about it. If you anticipate the problem, just call me, and we'll work it out, make sure we're doing the right thing. And if it's a close call, we always err on the side of don't do it. If it's a close call. Okay, quasi-judicial. I understand this kind of came up the other night and with racetrack. And the word quasi, I mean kind of halfway judicial. And really, if you think about how you are and how you should act and how you would want to be treated if you were in a judicial proceeding, that kind of encapsulates what I think regulations really ought to be known in a common sense sort of view. When you have a case before a judge, the judge is ethically precluded from having any input prior to the judicial proceeding from the participants. And if you were a plaintiff or a defendant in a lawsuit, you would want to know that the judge really doesn't know much about the case, from talking to witnesses or going there. He's sort of a blank slate. And so because the judge should start off at a neutral position on whatever the issue is. And with juries, it's the same way. And when juries get picked, one of the first questions the judge asks or the lawyers ask in selecting a jury is, do you know anything about the case? And if they do, they're excluded from the jury because they didn't start off in a neutral position. Once again, if you're a plaintiff or a defendant, you're a litigant in a case, you want the jury to be neutral at the starting point. They shouldn't really have any preconceived notions of what the case is about. The jury is also, how seriously they take that, the juries are also told repeatedly at the end of every day that you're not to go to the scene, you're not to read newspaper accounts about this, you're not to talk to any witnesses, you're not to talk to other jurors about it, because they want to keep them in that cocoon of everything that they get presented in terms of evidence is done at the public forum of a trial. So once again, if you are a litigant, that's what you want. You want to make sure that the process has the appearance of fairness and that everything's done is done out in the open. That's the due process you hear about from the Constitution. So when the court said as to legislative bodies, sometimes you're not just a legislative body where you should listen to constituents and you should talk to people in the community. You're doing the legislative action, what politicians, legislatures do, what y'all do 95% of the time in your job. Sometimes you act as judges in a quasi-judicial role. And so the courts have said, even though most of the times you're legislative and it's completely proper, and in fact it's expected of you to, you know, find out what the problems are in the community, bring those back, talk to people, formulate plans and whatever, when you're sitting quasi-judicially, you're like a judge or a jury. You should be in that neutral position. And it's improper for you to have contact with citizens, citizen representatives, lawyers, lobbyists, even on your own, going out there and really kind of sniffing out the side in advance of the hearing here from, you know, the public, what you should do or think about the case. And once again, if you were a property owner or you were for or against a particular zoning or for or against a particular, let's say, alcohol location permit, you would want to know that the people are going to make a decision that could be very weighty in terms of their financial future, how they use their property or don't use their property. They want to know that the five of you sitting here didn't talk to this lawyer or didn't talk to this lobbyist, that you're starting off in the neutral position, and that what you're hearing that's giving you the information you think you need to decide an issue one way or the other, everybody else is hearing. And if you think about that too, like a trial, that's incredibly fair, because if I can, I would love, you know, my capacity as a lawyer to have the ability to go talk to y'all in a quasi-judicial manner, in another setting, of course, when I'm not the city attorney, and say, you know, you really have to rezone this property this way or that way, and I can tell you anything. It may not even be true, and the other side doesn't get to hear it. And so you then come into the hearing and you have this preconceived notion of facts A, B, and C, but you don't, the opponent doesn't know that you think that. But if the opponent did know facts A, B, and C were told to you, those facts may be completely untrue. Those facts may be subject to, there's a different spin on it, another way of looking at it. And the other person, the opponent, doesn't know that you have that preconceived notion. So they don't even know to tell you, oh, you thought A, B, and C, well, let me tell you about D, E, and F. You know, they don't even know to tell you that because you've heard other stuff. So that's sort of the philosophical view behind this quasi-judicial stuff. And, you know, it's due process. Everybody thinks they know what due process is. But due process really means just fundamental fairness. How would you like to be treated? Golden rule type stuff. I mean, it really isn't all that complicated. So setting aside all the legalities, that's the way you're expected to act when it's quasi-judicial. I was looking through some of the materials here, and Jimmy sent you a memo telling you what stuff's quasi-judicial and what's not. And I think Ms. Heinbachel wanted it indicated on the agenda. So if it is quasi-judicial, you don't even have to think about it. You're told it's quasi-judicial, whether it is or isn't. You're told it's quasi-judicial. So that's how you expect it to act. Now, all that means is what I'm telling you. Don't, you know, somebody calls you. Usually it's going to be, probably not going to be a lawyer or, you know, some sort of lobbyist. It's probably 9 times out of 10 going to be a citizen that's affected by the decision. And they're going to want to call you or want to say, hey, can we meet and have lunch, or can we meet out at the site? I want to tell you some things and concerns or whatever. And guess what? What they're doing is completely proper. You accepting the invitation to do that's improper. And why I say what they're doing is proper is because they don't know any better. They think they should be able to talk to their legislatures, right? I mean, they're your elected officials. They should be able to talk to you about anything. So their desire to talk to you is, in my view, completely proper. That's what citizens do, right? When they've got a problem or they got a concern, they come talk to you about it. So what they're doing is completely proper. And how you react to their completely proper outreach is what you got to guard against. And it simply is, I can't do that. Politely. You need to go to council on, your hearing's going to be on such and such a night, and it'll be a public hearing, and I want to hear everything you have to tell me at that hearing about it, and any evidence you may want to present to me at that hearing, I want to see and consider, but I can't talk to you about it tonight. And by the way, I will not talk to anybody else, as a matter of telling them that. I want to assure you, I'm not going to talk to anybody else either, so you need to be assured that I'm going to hear everything I need to know by the people that show up that night at the public hearing and tell me about it. So, anyway, the courts, kind of, the Florida Supreme Court, or third, actually the Third District Court of Appeal, in the Jennings case, kind of articulated an opinion, what I've just been telling you as a general overview, this due process thing, and they said that if you do have these contacts with citizens or advocates on behalf of citizens on something that's quasi-judicial, there's a presumption that that was improper and that your decision could be ultimately overturned. Now, just because there's presumption doesn't mean it is a rebuttable presumption in that the courts will presume it was improper, but if you can show that, you know, through evidence that the decision would have been essentially the same, then you can rebut the presumption it was improper, and it goes on. I would say as to that notion, what I always say is that if you're explaining, you're losing. In my business, usually, is if you're explaining, you're losing. And so if there's a presumption you did something wrong and you're trying to explain it away, you're probably going to lose on that more often than not. That's number one. Number two, you know, God love you if you do it because it gets more work for me, but quite frankly, that's not. I think you can employ my services at a better use than litigating whether or not, you know, there was an improper contact with a citizen instead of, especially something you're probably going to, there's a good chance we're going to lose on anyway. In reaction to the Jennings case, the Florida legislature passed Florida statute, this is the second page, 286.0115, and they sort of expressed in the statute, read between the lines, they're expressing the sentiment that legislators are legislators and judges are judges, and if you guys kind of want to be legislators all the time dealing with your citizens, then the statute's going to sort of undo what the case in Jennings did. And it allowed you to talk to citizens in advance if they approached you and talk to them about what they wanted to talk to you about a quasi-judicial matter, but that you would have to adopt an ordinance that would then require you to disclose the information you receive from the citizen. Now, we've talked to multiple councils about this since the Jennings decision, and ultimately the statute was adopted about a year later, and the decision of council has always been not to adopt an ordinance under the FAR statute 286.0115 that would allow you to have those contacts, but then have a procedure for disclosing those contacts in quasi-judicial matters. I'm sort of an agnostic on that. I don't know that I care one way or the other. I recognize on one hand that you're legislators and legislators should do what legislators do. That's what the statute's basically saying. And then on the other hand, I do believe in this fundamental fairness, due process thing, and I see the value in that. But it's a policy decision whether or not you want to do what the statute says you can do. Some of you have been here, I think, when we talked about it. Some of you haven't. I'll regale you, I guess, at least with what I think some of the thoughts of other councils have been, or individual councilmen have been, is that, I won't say it's an easy way out, but it's an easy way out. It's nice to be able to say sometimes to citizens, if you're at Wolfie's. Wolfie's on Saturday morning, at least as to some stuff, that, hey, I'd love to talk to you about that, but I'm ethically precluded from doing that because that's going to be coming up in a quasi-judicial hearing. Obviously, it's not going to limit everything people talk to you from, and I'm not trying to insulate you from that, but I think some councilmen and women have expressed, you know, it'd be nice, it's a nice way not to be rude and tell people, look, can you come talk to me about a council, and I'm not just trying to get out of it, I just can't, and there's a rule rule says I can't, so show up at council. That's especially probably helpful where you know they're not going to show up at council anyway. You know, they want to lobby outside of council, tell you what they think, but it won't take the time to come to a public hearing. You know, how passionate can they be about it? But on the other hand, they are your constituents. These folks are your constituents, and you know, and it's a 6-1, half dozen the other, I guess, in which way you go. If you want us to do an ordinance, we will. If you don't, we probably need some direction on that too. So that's it in a nutshell. If you got any questions, or we can have some discussion on that.
Are there any questions? Discussion. We talked about doing an ordinance at the last meeting, and I think we decided as a council not to.
Okay.
Am I correct about that?
Yeah. And Pat, we can't, I mean, when we get these big ticket items like a racetrack and it's going, just, I mean, everything that was last week, I mean, we can talk to staff and have questions with staff or not. Is it really just complete isolation to just wait till the meeting?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for people not to have opinions. It's hard for staff's opinions not to bleed through. I mean, and you see how I struggle. You know, every one of you know I have opinions and have strong opinions about certain issues. And I tell you, I'm not here to advise you on policy, but you're aware that I have opinions. And so the struggle is always to make sure that it doesn't bleed through into how I give you legal advice. But I think it's the same to staff. They're normal people like anybody else. They have opinions. And if it's their business, they're going to have strong opinions. And that's a good thing. I mean, you know, Ty's going to have a strong opinion as a planner about this or that. And so if you go to Ty for advice on that, I think the opinion is a high probability that would bleed through. And I think that would verge on being proper.
And the emails?
Now, emails, you mean emails to
them? I mean emails, because we had, I don't know, we all had probably three or four, I think I had three emails.
They were group emails,
that pop,
right?
They're groupy. I mean, some would come individually, then you just get these, you know, like the racetrack, there was a, sometimes you get a form letter.
Right.
I mean, it's just one email that somebody types up, and then everybody attaches it to their email, and you send, but you can end up with, you know, sometimes three or four, sometimes you can end up with a dozen emails from people, you know, here's my reasons, and you'll get this long, big, drawn-out reason for...
There's not, you can't protect yourself from that. I would once you realize that somebody advocating a position on a quasi-judicial thing, I would probably just stop reading it, print it out, and then bring it to council and say, you know, I got this email. I didn't consider it once I realized it dealt with racetrack or whatever, but I'm going to read it and consider it now. And here it is in the record, if anybody wants to take a look at it. You know, there's a way to handle that.
Well, you know, Pat, you're talking about, you know, communication by staff to, you know, council members. The actual report that they put in your agenda says recommendation from staff is fill in the blank, you know, denial or whatever. So everything they write is based on their recommendation being in favor of or against it. So, I mean, they're communicating with you just by the mere fact of presenting it in an agenda item.
They
is
are.
That wrong?
That's a public document that's going to be the whole public as once they put it out to you. They're not putting it out to you secretly. They're posting that in the council agenda, which is on the internet. So everybody in the concern gets to see what you're being told, what the recommendation is. The problem would be is if, you know, Ty or planning staff recommends something and you know, you call Ty and you go, I see you recommended this, but you know, what about this and this? And Ty goes, well, you know, it was a close call, you know, but if they just changed this, this one thing, I would have been against it, or I would have been for it. I would have changed the staff recommendation over this little issue. Well, that's all, but that's not anywhere in the report.
Right.
Well, the source, now the citizen doesn't know that Ty has reported to one of the councilmen, you know, I would staff it before or against this if this thing got tweaked one way or the other. Now, if you put it in the report that was a concern, that's fine.
Right.
Then everybody's on the same playing field. So.
Okay, and just, you know, on other issues, I can speak with council members, but on an issue like this, I can't obviously speak to them, nor can I convey what feelings of other council members are to the other council members.
Well, you're in a unique position as mayor, and the sunshine law does not apply to you. You're kind of asking the sunshine and the quasi-judicial, they kind of go together.
Right.
But in terms of sunshine, as you know, you can talk to any one of the council members individually about pending business, because you're not a voting member of the council. You can't be the honeybee that goes from one to one saying, you know, Mr. McLeod thinks this way, and he's probably going to vote this way.
Right.
And don't tell Mr. Buzzley that. On the quasi-judicial thing, I don't think you would be like one of those outside sources, actually, if you went and talked to one of them. They need to say to you, if you were saying, look, I understand this rezoning is coming up for this particular piece of property, or this alcohol location permit's coming up for this particular piece of property, and we've had a lot of problems, OPD's had a lot of problems out there.
Right.
I want you to be aware of that. Once again, if you told that to Mr. McLeod, and then at the public meeting, the applicant's sitting there, and they have no idea that Mr. McLeod's been told by the mayor, the head of the police department, that there's been problems out at the property, there's no way for them to rebut that, or to say, here's how we're going to be able to fix it, or we're going to put a security camera. You know, there's no way for them to tell them that, because they didn't even know that was an issue.
Right. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Appreciate it.
All right. Next item on the agenda is a presentation concerning redistricting. And I'm going to turn that over to Ty.
Ty Chickazola, Growth Management Department. I have a short presentation, but I think Council President maybe wants to say a few things first.
Well, I do want to thank Ty and Angel and Lisa for working on this. We started pretty early in the year thinking that it was going to be something we'd get done quickly, and it just didn't happen that way.
Yeah.
And so anyway, but I appreciate your work, and you know, we got in there with crayons and calculators, and Lisa put all the maps together, and we just really appreciate it.
We want to thank her, because she did a very good job. It was like, I was amazed. I was like, I think we could hire as a planner. So
well, anyway, go ahead. Thanks.
Yeah. Redistricting, as you know, it's a charter requirement, and we have to do it every 10 years. We did it in 92, 2002, and now 2012. We look at districts 2 through 5, which are the non-at-large districts. And the boundaries, there's two things in the charter that says the boundaries should be kept equal, nearly as equal as possible, which is not always easy to do, and to stay within the precinct boundaries, if possible. And so there's some wiggle room there, and we have kind of always managed to mostly abide by the requirements in the charter. This year, we've had a couple of new issues, a couple things that have caused some changes that it's making a little bit more difficult, and maybe that's why we took a little bit more time. This year, the Supervisor of Elections changed the precinct boundaries for Marion County and Ocala, and we went from 45 in the city smaller precincts to 23 larger precincts. The larger precincts make it a little bit less flexible in terms of trying to make changes to districts. When they were smaller, we'd have more flexibility in making possible changes. But when this came back out, and again, we had already had done a couple versions of it based on the old precincts. When the new precincts came back out in June, then we had to kind of restart over, and our objective kind of changed a little bit. The next map is showing, it's hard to see a little bit of it, and I don't think you have this in your packet. It shows the blue is the new precinct boundaries, and the red were the old precinct boundaries overlaid on it. So you can see, especially in the yellow area up in the north, some of those were changed. Some in the middle section down in the south around Pine and Lake Weir went into from smaller districts to larger, and then in West Ocala there were some around State Road 40 that also went from smaller to larger districts. So those were some of our challenges going into it. And the other challenge is the growth. And I think we kind of saw this the last time we did it, that the population was increasing pretty fast this period of time. We had, the previous 10 year, we only had a growth of 3,900 people. This time we grew by over 10,000. So there was a significant increase in growth. And that growth occurred mostly in the southwest section of the city as a result of Heathbrook, Four Ranch, some of the larger apartment complexes off of State Road 200, Deerwood, which is in District 3, Bell Chase in District 3, Carlton Arms in District 2. So we had significant amount of our population growth occur in those two districts. The only growth that really occurred in District 5 was the Magnolias, and District 4 was mostly infill growth and maybe one new subdivision, Hunter's Ridge. So that was our challenge, to try to keep the district's boundaries as consistent as possible. So if you look at, this is our existing districts, and we've always been kind of north-south in terms of our district boundaries. We tried to keep that intact. I think it started back in the 80s with the new district configurations. And so the previous three maps had a north-south component to it. Again, that became more difficult as we try to adjust with the new population. Also, another factor we had to look at was also maintaining every council person in their existing district. So those are some of the things. And again, that took a long time because we were waiting for the new results to come in. And so we had many different versions. We had the Fiorello version, the Musley version, the Tillager version. So
exactly.
We had many different versions off of that. So it kept us quite busy in this process.
I'm not hearing a lot of confidence coming my way.
you see, you're right on the edge, Jay. We barely got you in.
Wow. We're a little shell-shocked around this place.
And he's right on the border, two houses away from the street. So if there's any shifting of the plates and it moves east, then you're in trouble. So
called the Priester effect.
Priester rule. So
any earthquake movement in Ocala, we're in trouble with districts. Right? So you can see, again, the districts were pretty north-south, except District 3 kind of went all the way down and picked up 200. That was a change that we did back in 2002. So those were our things that we needed to look at, and so we came up with two options, alternatives. Again, they're pretty much changes from what we've done before. You can see the north-south is kind of went away. District 4 and District 2 are now abutting each other. And District 3 is mostly wrapping around the southern end of the city. District 5 changed slightly, but not too much. So in that one, you can see that the balance is the smallest district is District 2. The largest one is District 4. One of the reasons looking at that, there's not much growth opportunity in District 4. District 3 and District 2, which are the two of the smaller ones under this scenario or this alternative, has potential for growth to occur under this scenario for these two districts.
So the range from the smallest district to the largest is
it's about 1,400.
1,400,
yeah. Which is a little bit more than previous ones.
Yeah. But that's where the larger precincts caused us trouble, because we would, as soon as you flip the precinct, then the one that you move it to becomes the biggest one, and the other one then becomes the smallest one. We always ended up with that same variance, that same range was, yeah.
And so, yeah, before the precincts changed, we had three alternatives, and it was much easier to work with the three alternatives, and they were kind of on opposite ends too. We had a little bit more options to maybe present, but once the precincts changed, then we kind of went in this direction. The next one is alternative two, and again there's more significant changes. Again, is between District 2 and 3, a little bit between 4. District 2 comes back towards Pine. That's always been in District 3. Under the other one scenario, was going to be in District 4. And then it also includes, back in District 2, includes Four Ranch, Carlton Arms. Now, the one thing we did do in this alternative, because we just could not make it balance, was to split Heathbrook and the rest of, I think it's Precinct 18.
Yeah.
To split it, Precinct 18, between Heathbrook and Carlton Arms. Four Ranch is its own separate precinct. They kind of made that in this last round as their own. But this option, this alternative, includes splitting the two, that precinct number 18, between Heathbrook and Carlton Arms is the major development out there in the purple. We felt this was an option to consider because it gets us close again with the population. It's a little bit more between District 2 versus District 4, the largest one. But at the same time, it's a dividing point that was there last time when Heathbrook was in District 3.
So, and then the range on this one is from the smallest
to the largest?
It's a little
bit, yeah, it's about 1,300. It's a little bit less than the other.
Right, so the alternative one has a larger range of population, but we don't split the precincts.
Right.
And alternative two, we were able to shrink the range, but we have a precinct that's divided. So yes, that's sort of the decision point.
I mean, the option would be to, if you wanted to really get them closer to each other, would be to split some of the precincts.
Some of the other precincts.
I mean, which you can do because we have the census block data, but again, it was something that we were trying to stick to as close as possible as to the charter requirements and not try to split as many precincts. So those are the two options, and we can discuss it. And then just on the last page before we can open it up and for discussion, again, once council gives us some direction where we're going to go with or what alternative, then we have to notify it 4 consecutive weeks in the newspaper, the new boundaries, and then adopt it by ordinance. And we hope to do this by the end of 2012 to keep us on schedule per the charter requirements.
Are there any questions or comments? Don't move across the street, Jack.
No moving, yes.
But the housing crash, you don't have to worry about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
My mortgage insures, I'll stay where I'm at.
If you turn back, can you go back to the first? As you can see there, you can see that District 2 went from 11.7 to 16.3, and District 3 went from 11.2 to 15. You can see that's where, again, what I was talking about was the growth, but those were the numbers.
Any questions, comments? Any preferences? Why don't we take public comment, if there's any public comment at this time? Would you please state your name and address for the record?
Whitfield Jenkins, 2200 Northwest 24th Road. Good afternoon, council persons and mayor. I'm here again. I was here 20-some years ago, representing NAACP in this process. This is the process, as many know, that carries with it a lot of other issues in terms of citizens and voting interests and voting rights. And if you go back 20 years ago and look at the city of Ocala and what the issues were, and issues that we talked about at that time, the key issue was at one point, the city council comprised a representative, none which looked like me. James Cunningham was our first elected city council person since Reconstruction. The NAACP at that time was addressing what was in place then was a totally at-large voting scheme that was part of the city charter, meaning that persons could run for office all from the same district, which in many cases pretty much was the case. A major section of the city which we call West Ocala, people refer to West Ocala, didn't have representation from Reconstruction until Mr. Cunningham was successful. We came to the council over 20 years ago discussing that issue and making a recommendation for single-member district concept. The discussion of council and the final decision was on a district boundary concept, which you have today, which means that for four of the districts, council persons must live in their respective full district and one at-large seat. So the seat that you have, I mean, the scheme that you have today is the results of that effort. We continue, we can hear today, when we started this process, I wrote a letter under the direction of the Marin County Branch NAACP Executive Committee, which came to all the city council persons at that time. I don't think Councilman Musley and Councilman McLoy, you were in your respective positions at the time, but the email communications came to all of the council persons, including the city manager and to some other officials. And basically, we requested to be allowed to participate in this process. And that intent was that if the city staff was going to have workshops and other things, that the public could be invited to, because we knew that we wanted to keep our focus on some key things, which I'm going to mention today. Ty has already mentioned that the growth, most of the growth was in District 2, as you know. That is the district that Councilwoman Mayor Sue Rich is elected in. It is a district, as you know, that black citizens very much supports and look to because of obvious reasons that growth occurred in that district. We were concerned, as you drew the new map, in terms of the voting inclusions that was going to be in that district. We were not looking for a dilution of that district in terms of the ethnic composition of voters. Now, we like to talk about that in terms of not race, but in interest, voting interest. As you know, the voting rights laws have set out some specific terms and criteria to protect the interests of voters. We look very much to District 2 as a district that represents major interests of our voters, and we certainly want to protect that. Now, the new map, I'm not sure yet. It's a question I want to ask Ty in terms of, as when I look at the old map and the draft that was put out, District 2 had the largest percentage of citizens under the old scheme, period. It was the largest. And the map that I was just handed a few minutes ago, I believe, it's now almost the smallest. So I want to know, in terms of this scheme, the race composition of those voters that was drawn out, those citizens that was drawn out of this scheme, because if the scheme is bleaching more of white citizens in District 2, that would be a concern to us. And so that is the question that I'm posing here today. Secondly, Ty mentioned the possibility for growth looking to the future. For that, and if that growth is 27, there is a subdivision out there, Ty, on 27 in front of the Winn-Dixie. Okay. Yeah, Ocala Palms is. Ocala Palms in District 2?
It's not in the city, but if it was annexed, then it would be in District 2.
In District 2. Now, yeah, looking at the future, if that's possible and the growth extend there, then I'm concerned that the persons that live in there changes the racial composition of the district completely. And so we would want to have the NAACP would want to have that looked at very closely. And basically what I'm saying is that in District 2, based upon the present situation and present circumstances, we want to make sure that the interests of our community is protected in the scheme that you finally make a decision on. So that's my reason for being here today. I do want to kind of remind you to kind of look at the map where the stars were put in terms of where the present city council person resides. And you see, it pretty much is no different than it was 20 years ago in terms of where they live. Now, we have heard the statements that, you know, people would represent that it doesn't make any difference that they vote for all citizens and take care of the needs of all citizens in the entire city. And we'll, today we won't argue that point. But the reality is that there are issues and needs that I can put forward today to bring questions in terms of the services and the needs of that still District 2 community compared to the other communities. So we will continue to be concerned about the scheme of the elected officials for City Council in terms of servicing all of the citizens in our community as well.
Thank you, Mr. McCall.
Yeah, I have a question, just a curiosity question.
Yes.
Mr. Jenkins, would you or the NAACP be in favor, and this is a curiosity question, I'm not leading with anything, of council members being elected from their district only?
Yes, that was our request 20 years ago. It still is our position today. It kind of probably is modified. If you talk to persons today, we may not be as intense on that as we were 20 some years ago. But as you know, I made a presentation to the county this year in their process, and we requested that, and we still are pursuing that from the county.
So you're asking the county to take a look at that also?
Yes.
And, because to my knowledge, I think that's what they do statewide for.
It doesn't work everywhere. We have studied this for many, many years, our national NAACP and our state. We have litigated this where we thought we needed to. There's a possibility we might be litigating the county on this issue for obvious reason that we haven't had a black county commissioner elected since Reconstruction to that body. But I think the city, we all obviously know that we've had some progress in the city, so I don't have a position today coming to you from the ZAVE committee that we are here today asking for single member district. But we certainly want to make sure that the gains that we made 20 years ago in terms of the concept that we have now, that concept serve our citizens and our community equal to any other portion of the community. And that when I say that, I'm talking about the services and all that you do for any citizen in the community, that we want that service to our community in equal fashion.
All right, and last question, just briefly. 20 years ago, you did advocate the single district.
Yes, we did.
Okay, and this was a modified version,
yes,
of kind of what you guys did.
Yes, and it was accepted in the final version after we carved out District 2 in the way that we did in terms of the population scheme. That is, as you know, after that, of course, though, Mr. Cunningham was elected outside of that decision, but Mr. Cunningham was kind of, if you call it, an aberration. We saw that as an aberration politically. We know some things that happened why Mr. Cunningham, but Probably if it had remained as it was, we would not have had Reverend Dr. Lorenzo Edwards and Ms. Rich to be as strongly entrenched in that district as in the previous years.
Okay, thank you for the information.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, so what direction are we looking for today?
To address Mr. Jenkins' question,
okay.
Back in 2000, the racial breakdown of District 2 was approximately 49, 41, 40%, 49 African-American, white, about 40%. What the problem was when the new population numbers came in from 2010, by taking in Four Ranch and Carlton Arms and some of those developments, at 16,000 total population, put a majority of white. It would be a majority of white, I think about 60 to 42 or something in there. 60 to about 60, 40, I guess it was, yeah.
Okay.
So that was one of the concerns that we looked at too when we went forward to try to bring it back, District 2, back to kind of the same percentages, and percentages and alternative. One is 49, 41 black versus white, and then 50 and 44 black versus white in alternative two. So those were some of the problems that we were facing, that we knew that the growth that occurred in District 2 was predominantly Four Ranch, was a breakdown of predominantly white, and some of that from Carlton Arms was predominantly white.
So we are back now at the percentages that we were.
Closer to the percentages that we were.
Closer to the percentages that we were in 2008.
Back in 2000, when back on the 2000 numbers, the 2002
When the changes were adopted in 2008, the percentages are about the same in District 2 as they were at that point.
It's the boundaries have changed, but the percentages have stayed close to.
Right. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Any preference as to which alternative we want to move forward with?
I like alternative one.
I agree. My concern with alternative two is the splitting of the precinct.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that I'm just concerned with the confusion that it might cause, you know, for someone who is potentially running for office. I don't know. Any other?
Map two splits
a precinct. So if you're in this precinct, the splitting of the precinct bothers me. More so than the amount of population that we gain by doing it, basically. Mr. McLeod?
I prefer one also.
Okay. What do you prefer?
I think one also for two reasons. I mean, the splitting of the precinct and then maintaining the interest, as Mr. Jenkins talked about. Future growth out 27, two will expand going that way.
Mm-hmm.
Northwest down 27.
Excuse me, Madam Council Lady. I know I'm out of protocol, but you're talking on a point that I just want to make sure.
Okay, let Mr. Owen finish his comments.
See the one that you've got there.
Yep.
So, Mr. Jenkins was talking about Ocala Palms and any of that starts hitting. You see 27 there, right? So, is any kind of growth that may or may not happen as we move forward, that would all be encapsulated into District 2.
Mr. Jenkins.
Yes, I just want to go on record to make sure on that point we're very clear. Probably the most important point for us for my purpose of being here today, would be the map that has the least amount of change in terms of African-American population in District 2. That would be a great concern to the NAACP.
I think map one meets that.
Map one meets that.
Definitely meets that, that suggestion by Mr. Jenkins. And I think we just have to deal with future annexation as it happens.
Right.
Don't know.
Right.
We had talked about if a telephone came back in 2008 when we did the referendum, we had talked about opening it back up again.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible to open it up if annexation occurred that skews the district. And again, that would really push District 2 at the time close to 19,000 people in District 2 based on the numbers. So there was consideration that by council at that time, if we do include the telephones, that we would open it back up. That didn't happen.
Right. Mr. Jenkins.
Yes.
Is map two the one you'd prefer? I mean one.
I looked at the percentages in terms of 6 and 8. I think if you look at in terms of they vary, one would be 6%, and I believe 1 8%. If you did a subtraction. And the one, I'm not looking at it, but the one that would be 6% would be most favorable for the NAACP. It's in that left-hand category on the two maps. Okay, I'm looking at map alternative one, 41% African-American, 49% white. That would be 8. So
now you got that reversed.
That's reversed.
No, 49 black.
You have.
Oh, okay.
You're 8 percentage points.
Yes, yes.
More black than white.
Okay, yes.
And the other one, you're only 6 percentage points more black than white.
Yes.
So you would prefer the 8?
Wait, I'm looking different than you. Okay, white is 41, 49. It would be map one would be the preferred map with the 40.
Okay.
And like I said, with the 2,000 percentage, it's almost exactly the same. I think it was 49 to 40 point something. So it was right.
Okay. So is alternative one good for you, Mary Sue?
Yeah.
All right. So we'll move forward with alternative one.
All right, thank you. We're going on to item number 3B, the wayfinding signs. I think Janine's going to lead us in that conversation. No?
Janine Robbins, Public Communication. I'm just going to provide council with a brief update on the logo implementation while Ty is setting up the renderings of the wayfinding proposals. Earlier this month, I distributed a logo implementation plan to the organization, and contained in that were directives in terms of when to use the logo, where it was going to be used, when not to use the logo, when to use the seal. And just high level, we will be, the logo's already been implemented on letterhead, and anything that's electronic that we can do very inexpensively as resources and necessity permit, we will be replacing logos on city vehicles. Uniforms is up in the air right now. I believe we're in the middle of a uniform procurement renegotiation, so we're waiting until that comes to fruition before we move forward with that. And just for council's information, I did check with the code, and the only time the code requires that we use the seal is for treasury bonds, official city maps, and historic city maps. Any questions? Comments? Snide remarks? Thank you.
What are we looking at here?
Merge was going to be here today. They were actually going to be here on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, but because of the storm and a lot of outside work they had to do, we decided to go ahead and cancel. So we didn't. They had already sent the presentation, and so what we're looking at right now is the next phase, which is the wayfinding signage. We're in the process of completing the maps, working with DOT, and finalizing where the signs will be, and also the look of the gateway and the different types of signs that we're going to be presenting. As you know, if the budget gets approved, then we'll be able to start the fabrication of those signs October 1 or sometime after that. But yeah, here's the, again, this would be an option for the wall on the wastewater wall on US 441. Or it could be, we'll show you later. And then this is also a gateway sign. We thought this would be possibly a different alternative to be located either along the interstate or even closer to downtown. Then here's some more options in terms of gateway signs where you have the main, a secondary, then a tertiary different one based on scale. What are you talking about? Possibly a neighborhood or a location. Again, these are what the signs would look like in the back side. So there's four different kinds as we get closer into downtown. Then here would be the downtown signage. And I think y'all saw a little bit of this in one of the earlier presentations. This would be the kiosk. And specifically to downtown, some of the wayfinding. And then some more signage, vehicular things that we do would be needed, vehicular as well as pedestrian. And some of these are a little bit more bland because, especially like on these, the signs have to meet DOT requirements. Hopefully we will. We still have to go through that process. They have strict requirements in terms of what can be placed on the different signs and what fonts and everything to use. So those have to be a certain size lettering so you can see the sign from a distance as well as the parking signs. So those are the different options there.
You can just leave that right up here.
Yeah.
I guess at this point, some feedback. Maybe we'll be back in a couple of weeks, maybe at the next workshop. We can tack them on if they're here for the 11th or possibly the 25th. We're not quite sure when their schedule is going to be able to make it back down here.
Any questions or comments?
Can we add the seal on some of those bigger ones?
No.
answer me.
No.
Not you. Not Bill in the sign.
I'm not sure I heard you.
Anything else?
No, I guess that's about it.
Any comments, questions?
I'm just curious, what doesn't look good about all of that? I mean, you just try to picture some of those, the post office chamber and, Martin Luther King rec complex. I mean, all of those things. I mean, you just driving down the road and all of a sudden you start to see that and it's consistent and it's just what it is. I mean, you start getting a real, that sense. Feel of being able to get around and I just, it looks good, but what doesn't look good about any of that?
Well,
I was in Tampa last week, as you know, attending the trip to Port of Tampa. And the city of Tampa has a Hawaii signing program, as many cities do in the state now. Theirs is also very nicely done, very attractive. Merged it there as well. And what I found unique about it, as you drive by at 30 or 35 miles an hour, you can see it, you see that it's a wayfinding sign, and the branding is large enough and clear enough that you can see it and understand what it means driving by that fast. Ms. Rich, you talked about the seal. I'm not sure you could read it all at 35 miles an hour as you're driving by it. But something simple like this that's colorful, has a flare on it, is really eye-catching. And I think Tampa did theirs very well. I think Orlando's got a great one. And this is following along some of the themes that we're seeing in other communities to help establish identity here in Ocala.
Rich, I was looking at the two signs out there for Citizen Circle.
I think it looks good.
Looks good to
me. I noticed you got all the little signs down there, Marion Theater, County Courthouse. Didn't see one for the school board anywhere. Mr. Owen probably has that one.
That's the one where the dog got his leg hiked up.
The more difficult thing is, in order to put some of these signs up, there's a need to take signs down that have mysteriously appeared on the corridor. Schools, churches, and stuff like that. So that's going to be the rough part. You
know? Say that again, Ty.
There's been a lot of signs that have been put up over the years. Not always, when DOT roadway is not always approved by DOT. So I think they're going to be looking to put up the new signs and take out some of the older signs.
Okay.
We have one for every school going this way, that way, a church, and everything. So.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of signs, clutter in the corridor that they may want us to address. So.
Okay. And that's FDOT wants us to address or merge?
FDOT, yeah.
Right, right.
There's certain requirements they have to
right.
Abide by.
Looks good.
Outstanding. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
That's all we have on the agenda. I'll turn the time back over to the council president.
Are there any other public comments on anything that we discussed today? I see that there's just crowds of people here that. All right, we're adjourned.
I'm going to eat my sandwich.
Thank you so much.
So you took them down, huh?
I did. It was nice.
Great for a quarter player, nice.